thanks for coming and thanks for giving us a chance to talk with you. This is what today's about, but if someone asks me what I do and what we do in bioacoustics, it's pretty simple. We listen to the world. And in particular, we listen to the natural world because it's always telling us something. And we do it on a global scale. So we are presently recording around the world in various places, both on land and in sea, and even by putting instrumentation into the dirt to listen to what travels through the substrate. But the story we're going to tell you about today is remarkable in that it's a story that's been evolving and underway for a couple of years right off of the city that never sleeps. And some of the things I will tell you about today are things that we have forgotten as a society. That is, you could go back into the library that's not too many blocks away from here, and you could find in the library records of Long Islanders hunting whales off Long Island and rendering them down into flesh and oil. That was over 100 years ago, and we seem to have forgotten that there used to be lots of observations of whales in the Hudson, in New York Harbor, off Long Island, et cetera. And several years ago, we started working with the Department of Environmental Conservation in New York and put some recorders off of New York Harbor and off of Long Island. And lo and behold, in the first hour that we opened them up and started listening, we had whales. And so we're going to tell you some of that story today and something about some of these whales and some of the surprises. And really, I really hope you guys are all, you're homozygous for interaction, so please just engage. So this is an image that I would like to actually see in MoMA, in that it has no labels on it. It's science. It's a visual representation of actual data, except I have no axes on this picture, so you don't know exactly what it is. And what it is it's a rendering of sound collected in the Pacific Ocean, in this case. It could be the Atlantic Ocean, over a one-year period. And what we do in science is we convert this lengthy recording. This has now been going on for over 10 years. We convert the recording into a visual representation, just like a musical score. But in this case, the musical score is 1 year long, so it's 1 year from January 05 to January 06, and this is pitch or frequency in the unit we call hertz or cycles per second. So those of you who are musically inclined, there's orchestral A up there, and here's 20 hertz below our auditory threshold. Now you might go to a record store or in the old days you'd go to Sam Goody's or something like that and you'd buy an amplifier and it would say 20 to 20K, right? 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. That was sort of the audiophile's range, but here were 20 hertz. And what you're looking at here is think of yourself just diving into the ocean with Sylvia Earle in a bubble or something like that, just going down to the bottom of the ocean, and you're just going to listen for a whole year. And you're going to collect that memory, and this is a visual representation of that memory. And you see this glow over here? This is the glow over about a three-month period of the collective voices of a population of blue whales and fin whales from a single sensor sitting on the bottom of the ocean halfway between Honolulu and San Francisco. This is the same phenomenon that we're now listening to and have been listening to in New York, in upstate New York, wherever, frog ponds in Connecticut. It's the bloom of life. This is the singing life of the whales in one little place in the ocean. And yet every place we listen, we hear the singing planet. So this is, I want you to think of this scale. This is the scale over which we need to listen. Not for 5 minutes, not for 45 minutes, not for a week, but for years. This perspective allows us to answer questions such as, what is happening in the ocean when we do X or Y or Z? What happens when we overfish? What happens when we pollute? What happens when we make so much sound that the whales can't hear each other? It's this perspective that we need to understand. So off New York, we found that we have some of the greatest animals on Earth. I'm going to play you some of their sounds. I'm going to try and give you a sense of the scale of their voices, okay? So just as I showed you this picture here, this voice, this is the singing of two species of whales, the largest animals ever to exist on this planet, the blue whale and the fin whale, the two largest species. And this might sound a little nerdy, but if you see that little, can you see that little glow up here? That is the collective energy from the note, one note that these animals sing as part of their song. They have one note that's up here a little bit high enough that you could actually hear it if you were in a boat. But that's the voice. It's low frequency. You can't hear it. It's infrasonic, just like bats and dolphins are ultrasonic. So now, this is the scale, the space over which these animals can communicate and could communicate very readily prior to ocean shipping. So I can literally, I have listened to a blue whale singing up off the Grand Banks of Canada. I've heard that whale while recording it off of Puerto Rico, 1,600 miles away. So the voice of a blue whale can be heard across an ocean basin. We don't know if they're actually paying any attention to each other, but if I can hear it, I'm pretty sure the whales can hear it. But that's the space over which they communicate.
Pre-shipping.
Pre-shipping means pre-industrialization of the ocean, prior to steam or engine-driven ships. So it's basically the last. Yeah, it's pre-commercial. Well, okay, pre-engine-driven ships. Sorry. So it's basically the last 50 or 60 years. Really, the biggest influx in shipping has been since the Second World War. Of noise. So now I'm going to play you that song. This is recorded from a blue whale 650 miles away, and I sped it up 30 times. And so this is, a musical score. So this is time going this way. It's 18 minutes long, and this is pitch. And I had to speed it up and so you could hear it. And each one of these is a note of a song. It'll sound much like an owl. And I sped it up 30 times. See? Why is it doing that? Here we go. This was 650 miles away. This whale was off of Canada, and this was recorded off of Bermuda. So that gets you a sense of the depth of the voice, because if I tried to play this to you in real time, you wouldn't hear it. And we'd be sitting here listening for 18 minutes, and you're going, what the heck is this guy talking about?
How are you able to track the whale to that sense,
okay, I've been using the U.S. Navy's underwater anti-submarine listening system since the early 90s. So actually track, I can locate the animal, position it, and then track it. Right whales. These are the North Atlantic right whale. This is a species that's on the brink of extinction. There are roughly 450 of them left in the entire North Atlantic. And these are quite interesting. Notice this is the head right here. There's obviously the tail. The eyes are down below here. And here are their right and left arms, which are big, broad paddles. And this head, notice they have different markings on their head. We use that to identify individuals. Now I'll play you these calls at normal speed. I don't have to speed these up. Oopsie. Why does it do that? Oh, I'm just hitting the wrong button. Here comes a social group. So if we went off of Long Island sometime and played all those back, you could probably call in males from over the horizon, because those are the sounds of a right whale orgy. And yeah, I could, I'd have to, we have to go into a triple X rated if I started telling you about right whale sex. So this is a conceptualization of something we just experienced. So blue whale, I just played you. And what I'm doing now is I'm putting your minds into this space of a, where does your voice, where does your acoustic communication, where does it reside in pitch and in time? The blue whale's voice is so, so low and very, very long and very, very loud. And it's quite unique. So I'm placing it in this space, and it's entirely different. So I played you those two voices, right? I played you the voice of the blue whale, and I played you the voice of the right whale. The blue whale can communicate over an ocean basin. The right whale will communicate over many tens of miles, right? So it could, you might be able to hear a blue whale, sorry, a right whale that was out in Riverhead. You might be able to hear it back in, you know, in Queens, right, over that distance. But you're not going to hear it all the way from Bermuda to New York. Whereas a blue whale, that's certainly the space. So these animals occupy, think of them as occupying different niches, just like a frog sound is different and occupies a different space and has different pitches in it than a cardinal or a robin. So what we've been doing along the East Coast and now in the Gulf of Mexico is for over a decade, we've been recording using these little things we call pop-ups, these pumpkins. And we've been distributing them all along the East Coast. So each of these red dots represent where we've been recording. And you notice that there's sort of a paucity of recording in the mid-Atlantic states. And these are pretty simple instruments. And engineers at Cornell have designed and built these. And we now have a fleet of roughly 140 of these operating year-round. We call them pop-ups, or marine acoustic recording units, or I like to call them pop-ups, and that's because they release off the bottom of the ocean. They come floating up to the surface, and when they get there, they sort of pop out of the water. And what we do with that, and now I'm not in New York anymore, sorry. I grew up in Massachusetts. I grew up in Wellfleet and Truro. And what I'm going to show you is something about their communication, because the whole thing is, what are these animals doing this? Why is this important, right? Well, the importance is to understand not only that they're there, and if their populations are in good shape and they're healthy, then healthy whales realize or mean that there's a healthy ocean, and a healthy ocean is good for humans. So here we have five of those pop-ups in the bay, and notice there's a little clock up there, and this was a few years ago. And using this, just like, as I said, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, sir.
Ira.
Talked about locating blue whales using Navy arrays over an entire ocean basin. Well, now we're doing the same thing in this little puddle called Cape Cod Bay, and we're going to locate, whenever a whale makes a sound, we locate it. And so you're going to see a little orange dot show up, and that's when a whale makes a sound, we locate it. Okay, so you're going to see little yellow dots. There's the clock at the top. And see, they're making tracks. Now, this isn't visual. This is all acoustics. I'm following you as you go through the woods, and you're calling each other. And you'll notice these two animals are going to meet up. And what they're doing is they're counter-calling. So Ira, you would go, and I would go, like this. And we'd have our little signatures, and we'd go back and forth, like the musketeers kind of thing, right? Or mouseketeers, right? So we can do these kinds of analysis, and what it shows us is how many whales are there, what they're doing, and most importantly, how critical it is that they can hear each other and communicate, because this is how their whole social system is maintained. This is their network. Their network is acoustic. They can't see each other. This was pitch dark. It's middle of the night. All of my friends that fly airplanes and go around in boats are all asleep, but the whales are quite busy. And we've been doing this quite intensively off of Massachusetts. Using these recorders, and then we have a network right now operating Working with Woods Hole engineers, we have a network of real-time buoys that are in the shipping lane, and that is those data are being broadcast to mariners so that the ships can slow down and avoid, hopefully reduce the chances of hitting whales. So off New York, a few years ago, in a collaboration with the New York Department of Environmental Conservation, and this is Nicole and another graduate student, Ingrid Beerdren, went off and we used the ship from Stony Brook University and their captain, who was a great fisherman, and we deployed units off of Long Island and off of New York. So these are distributed offshore about 10 miles apart, coming out of the middle of Long Island off Jones Beach, and then three in the middle. Now what this allows us to do is this is a little network, and we can actually locate and track whales, just like I showed you in Cape Cod Bay. And we can do the same somewhat with this network as well. So it's basically an acoustic net that's designed to capture the whales, in this case, as they're migrating along the coast. And you can see the New York Canyon here and the shipping lanes coming into New York. So one of the first surprises that we had was in the first hours of listening to the recordings, we found right whales. And this shows you simply the size of the circle represents how many calls we heard on each of the different units. So you can see during the early part, right in March and April, that first month, most of the whales were in close to shore. And then the surprise was in the latter part of the migration, most of the whales were off here. Now, why this is interesting is that the regulators have always thought that the whales were only in close to shore, and what we found by listening is the whales are actually offshore out to 70 miles offshore, and they're actually going right through, you know, it's cutting right through the shipping lanes. So they are at risk of being struck. And oh, in these early days, we didn't have many right whales in the harbor, but when we listened to the rest of the year's data, we actually found right whales off the harbor as well. Now, you guys are all being awfully quiet. Is this because I'm going too fast or it's boring or okay? Then the other surprise was listening for other things. And all right, so here's that same kind of musical score. So this is 24 hours. So this is a day represented here. And here's that pitch again. So it's very, very, we're mapping in a very low frequency. So this is infrasonic, below auditory threshold. And what you're seeing here, all these bands of noise here, these represent singing fin whales. If you look closely, you see how this is broken up into little chunks? That's when the whale is singing a song, comes to the surface and breathes, sings another song, breathes, song, breathes, right? So this is what we call a singing bout, just like you'd have a cardinal or a sparrow singing in a tree. But what was interesting is, see these little squiggles down here? So this is really whale nerdy stuff, right? Right down here, that little bit of energy, right down that dark right there, you zoom in, stretch it out, and lo and behold, what do you see? That is the voice of a blue whale. I was completely shocked because I thought the only way we were going to find a blue whale is by listening to this recorder way out here on the shelf edge. So this was in about 700 meters of water. So we were thinking, okay, that will be able to pick up the voice of a blue whale singing off of Bermuda because I know they were coming by Bermuda. But instead, you'll see that the whale was right closer than I ever expected. So there's the voice. And I'll play it to you now. So this is a blue whale off New York on the 23rd of January. I'm just going to play it to you at 5 times normal speed. If I played it to you at one speed, you wouldn't hear it. And you'll hear in the background some pulsing. That's a fin whale singing in the background. Ooh. you hear it back there? Now, when I discovered this over on an early Saturday morning with a cup of Java at about 4 o'clock, because I was so excited about finding this thing, I was pretty blown away because wait a minute.
So that kind of like bongo sounding noise, that was the fin whale you said sort of layering over the blue whale?
Yeah, so here, let's look at this one. So I was trying to filter out the blue whale. I'm trying to filter out the fin whale. So the fin whale is singing on top, right up in here, and there's the voice of the blue whale. So this is the basso profundo, right? And this is the bass. And they separate out their voices slightly. So what you were hearing when I play it fast, you hear that boom, or you hear the boom, boom, because you'll hear the note I sing is very low and it's very short. It's about a second long and it just sounds like a little burp. It's a mmm, like this. And you'll hear the echo or the reflection of my voice off the surface of the ocean. So the voice comes directly to your microphone. It also goes up and hits the surface of the ocean and comes to your microphone a few seconds later. So you often hear almost like a heartbeat. You hear a boom, 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 like that.
But so that heartbeat then, that's the same, that's the blue whale, but just bouncing off the top and then coming back to the bottom?
No, the boom boom is the fin whale.
Okay.
And the blue whale is that, the long one. So it's this little glow here represents the longer note. Okay? Yes?
And how far away was this blue whale?
I'll show you. This whale was right off about 60 miles off of Long Island. Yeah, and going right along, parallel to Long Island, and heading west, and then cut down and went along the coast of New Jersey. So here I'll play this at 20 times. So you'll hear the... So the pulsing is the fin whale, and the owl is the blue whale. And then when we get over here, you'll notice it gets a little bit funky. You'll actually hear a second fin whale in the background. It almost sounds syncopated. Whoops, sorry.
Excuse me, how close were these whales to one another?
The fin whale was probably about 40 miles away. But for the whales, this is right next door. So that's part of the sort of the mind stretching you need to do, is that if I can hear you several hundred miles away and I can swim at a leisurely pace of 5 miles an hour, I can do that for 24 hours, hey, I'll see you tomorrow morning, right? The whole world is stretched. Does that make sense? Okay. So you can, you know, I can speed it up even more, and then this is when you start hearing. And what do you notice about this? It's really regular, right? This is like rap, right? These are just, it's just rhythm, right? And it's not the melodious voices that you would have heard if you've ever listened to humpback whales, which are singing over 7 octaves, and they have a bass voice, a tenor voice, an alto voice, a soprano, a mezzo-soprano. I mean, they have all the voices, right? These guys are just steady, loud, and they're beautifully designed to be traveling over hundreds and hundreds of miles in the ocean. So what do you hear? You hear rhythm, right? In fact, just now, for those of you who have excellent rhythm, it's metronomic. And I could teach you in a few minutes to recognize the singing pattern of a fin whale from Iceland versus one from Portugal versus one from Mexico, because their rhythms are different and they'll have different, in fact, the Mexican ones are syncopated. And if you may not have noticed, but this space in here, which only represents 3 or 4 minutes where the animal came up to breathe probably, they will go down and, they come up to breathe and go down again, and they'll come in on the rhythm. So I would challenge anybody in New York to be able to keep rhythm out to 5 minutes. And these are sung every 70 seconds. So they have incredible internal clocks. So you heard that little elf tapping in the back room. This is very, very low frequency, long range. So we were able to pick that up. And so here's the whale when we first located it. And here's the network that we have. Here's the shelf break where it's getting shallow coastal down to deeper water. Whoops. So the whale lights up, the calls are coming in. We're tracking it acoustically. Swims right through the array. And then starts heading down the coast. So this was a complete surprise to me that we would have. So you see what we're doing? We're the whale is singing, and I'm able to actually position the whale because I'm recording it on multiple channels. This is just a data slide. I'll explain it. So we have right whales, blues, and fins. And we're looking at spring, autumn, winter, different seasons. And of course, the fin whales are basically there all the time. Lots of fin whales.
Is this a specific year?
This was 2007, 2008. So we only...
These charts that we're looking
right,
at
so
here.
This was part of the sadness here is we were supposed to be doing this over a much longer period, and our funds got cut, so we couldn't continue with the project.
So 2009 was the last year that you
guys
had
these there?
Was
it 2009? Or was it early 2009? We released the data. Yeah, so it was only a 9-month period. We were supposed to go for longer, but it got truncated. And so it would be fantastic to me that we should be listening to New York all the time. We should be listening for whales off New York all the time. So we have, basically you have a residential population of fin whales. They're living off New York. And in particular, when I made statements about fin whales, where they are is they're singing. If you were standing on the top of the Verrazano Bridge and looked out onto the ocean, southeast of New York, you would be looking onto the ocean, the stage under which those whales are singing. And these are some of the greatest voices on the planet that can be heard over many, many hundreds of miles. And blue whales, that was a complete surprise that we had this many blue whales in the wintertime on those units. We have not heard, we've not picked up a blue whale voice up off the enclosed near the harbor. But we have had right whales throughout the spring. We've even had them in the wintertime. And we've even had right whale calls in close, which was, again, was a complete surprise. Because right whales can't be heard that far away. So if I hear a right whale off of New York, that means that whale's probably only 10 miles away or so, 5 to 10 miles away.
What is it about New York's waters that why are so many fin whales?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, yeah, I could be sort of facetious and say, why would a fin whale want to hang out off of New York? But then you could
you could write some pretty cool stories about that too.
Right. Right? Yeah, just because there's so many compared together.
Yeah. Well, back a few years ago, there were whale watching boats being run out of Riverhead, and they were going out of Riverhead to look for sperm whales, and of course what they kept finding was there were fin whales. And they would take photographs of the fin whales, and they were going, wait, we have some of the same whales coming back year after year after year. And this is pretty true for fin whales. They seem to have local residency. They can move over huge distances. So these animals could just take off and swim 500 miles and go up to Labrador and feed for a couple of months, then come back. But this seems to be that they have these local affinities for specific places.
They like New York.
Hmm?
Yeah, it seems they like
They like New York. Right. So we better, yeah, better check them out. But the fact that they're right there all the time is quite remarkable. Now, there are people who, there are whale watching boats that are saying that they're seeing, and I know people that are working on this, just doing aerial surveys and boat surveys and saying, well, fin whales seem to be coming back. We are seeing more and more fin whales throughout the ocean. And right whales, there's a little bit of hope. We've had about 4 years of good reproduction activity, calving activity. Right whales are not resident off New York. They're moving through the waters. But again, part of my motivation is to inform the world that these animals are here. And shouldn't we be excited that they're some of the greatest whales on the planet right off of New York? They may be migratory, but they're obviously in the area for many, many months at a time. And right whales are, you know, one of the most endangered species on the planet. So these are the kinds of, this is the information we were starting to gather, and then we ended up having to stop the project altogether. And so what we're hoping to be able to do is rejuvenate this and start listening. And ideally, what I think would be absolutely fantastic is to take, we've built these units, which are called real-time auto detection buoys. We have them we've put them off Jacksonville, we put them off Savannah, we're putting some up in the Arctic Ocean, we have them off of Boston. And those have uplinks to satellite uplinks, and they're transmitting back acoustic data. They can do it almost continuously. And what I would love to be able to have is a system where you could go on the internet any time of day, log on and listen to New York, right? There's no reason why we can't do it. We've engineered it, we've got all the systems working, and every, you know, child and kid and adult and grandmother or whatever it is should be able to just, hey, let's listen to New York, let's listen to what's there. And so you shouldn't have to rely on a bunch of people up in Ithaca, New York with little, you know, funny caps on their heads to tell you that they're whales off New York. You should know it in real time. Yes?
How does the shipping traffic here compare to, say, Boston?
Shipping traffic in Boston is minor compared to New York. This is a major hub, right? Now, as I understand it, Jacksonville is the fastest growing. I don't know, is Jacksonville taken over New York, or still New York is number one?
Los Angeles, Long Beach, New York.
No, East Coast.
Savannah is fastest growing.
New York, okay, so we've been monitoring Savannah and Jacksonville.
Jacksonville's weird because it has Navy. Lots of Navy on the St. John's River.
Yeah.
And that doesn't show up in the data.
Right.
Oh, I was just wondering, the pop-ups are the sorts of things where all the data are self-contained and then you have to go get it?
Yes.
Okay, so it keeps a whole year's worth.
Yeah, we typically retrieve them after 3 or 4 months,
okay,
rather than waiting a whole year.
And they're self-releasing, they just come up to the seafloor.
Right. Or you can go out and you can send them a little message and say, hey, break away from your anchor and come back to the surface. Yeah. But that's right. So that's not real time. That is, you have to wait. Yes.
Sorry, I just had a, because I know with the Boston project, some of the real time, the funding for that network came from the, or part of it at least came from the shipping industry, because there's this, you know,
right,
it's part of reducing ship strikes. So
yes, that the Boston situation is really unique in that two LNG companies which wanted to build or have built two terminals each, LNG terminals, this was essentially the cost of doing business off of New York, I mean off of Boston.
Right.
So they are paying for the deployment, the maintenance, the analysis, all of that. That's part of their cost of doing business.
Is it off Cape Cod or off Boston?
It's here. It's in the shipping lane. It's the network comes from here right into here, and then we have a whole network of right in Mass Bay. Yeah, so there are 10 real-time buoys that are constantly monitoring for right whales. And again, this is one of these situations where the buoys are quite sophisticated and they have a pretty decent brain on them, and their brain is being used about 10% of the time. So we could be listening for lots of other things. But that was quite remarkable in that that was the cost of the LNG businesses doing business off Boston.
So you can. Less likely to happen here because the policies are different.
Well, this is okay. I'll have to be careful here. This is what's so interesting. The same agencies, exactly the same agencies: Department of Commerce, Department of Transportation, Homeland Security, Coast Guard, you know, Army Corps of Engineers, right? Those same agencies are the same agencies in New York, or off Jacksonville, or off Savannah. And yet, I've been to meetings of the Port Authority, and it's as though you're talking to two different groups of people. Well, you are talking to two different groups of people, but it's as though they don't even know what's going on in their agency. So the precedent's been set, right? And this is now rippling into what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico. It's already, precedence has also been set in the Arctic in terms of if you want to do these things, then the following protections have to be put in place. But off New York, there's no one's building an LNG terminal in the near future based because of the economics. Although there were plans to build an island and there were plans to bring LNG. And also this now gets into the whole wind issue, right? Offshore wind energy. Anything that could impact endangered species triggers lots of actions.
To elaborate on what she was saying, I just want to make sure I understand what's happening here in New York. So you guys had funding from the DEC in 2009,
mm-hmm.
dropped the buoys, did the recording, and have had no money since then from the state to do that, and that's why the buoys haven't been deployed since?
Correct.
And then to contrast that with what's happening with the permanent recording up in Boston, that money, is there some state equivalent of money going or some federal money or uh-huh. a combination? What's the funding for it?
So off Boston, you know, if you look at this scene, off Boston, you know, we're maintaining this whole network, a field of 39 recorders in these habitats. This is the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. Here are the shipping lanes. So off Boston, this has been going on for, well, this level for 3 years, 3.5 years continuously, and in some of these other cases for almost 10 years. So we have state aid, we have federal aid, we have commercial aid. I shouldn't say aid, we have funding, right? But there's nothing off New York.
And is New York State the missing piece, or is it that you don't have buy-in from federal agencies to do it here in this region?
I don't know that I have the full answer to that. I know that the Department of Environmental Conservation has been unable to continue the funding. In fact, we didn't actually receive our full funding. That was cut. And so there hasn't been really state buy-in. In fact, one of my, I don't know what it would be, so irreverent comments is that, wait a minute, the state of New York, If you ask someone, well, does the state of New York have any coastline? Yeah, I think so. It's called Long Island, right? Do we have endangered species? Yes, we have endangered species. Do we have a requirement and responsibility to be monitoring for those endangered species? Damn straight we should, right? But the socks have fallen down, or maybe they were never pulled up. And you're going to tell me I'm going to get in trouble if I make any more statements. But I find it actually just absolutely irresponsible the way New York has not dealt with its coastal habitats and its marine habitats. We have endangered species of turtles. We have endangered species of migratory birds, you know, whatever. There's a big ocean out there off of New York. And the fact that we have, you know, Oh, I didn't tell you that when we've looked into these data, we were only supposed to be monitoring for right whales at first. Well, then we found blue whales and fin whales. We found humpback whales. We found minke whales. We found sei whales. We found 7 out of 12 of the greatest whales on Earth, right? We're not missing any. Bowhead whales don't come down from the high Arctic into New York. Gray whales reside over in the North Pacific. Southern blue whales don't come up into the northern hemisphere. So we've found all of the great whales off New York. And to me, we should be celebrating this, right? This is like fantastic, right? We have an opera going on there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, which is right off the greatest city on the planet, right? Or the city that never sleeps. And to me, it's like, wow, we should be listening to this. And you may want to talk about this. We get fish. Is anybody interested in fish off New York? When you listen, we have more things on these recordings that we don't know what they are than we know what they are.
So is this just like a budget thing? I mean, have you guys been talking to like the Cuomo administration or the DEC? Have you looked to Jersey for joint funding?
Maybe I should go see the mayor.
I don't know.
No, it really is. It's a matter of willpower and budget, right? And this is, we're not talking, you know, this is not exorbitant. But
how much is it?
Well, to install, you know, a real system would be about $350,000 a year. And
per
so,
For a permanent system or a?
No, the auto detection buoys, that would be more expensive. But the amazing thing about all of that is, all of the engineering costs have been paid for by the commercial activities off of Boston. All the technology, it's basically, you know, it's add water and stir, Bisquick, right? You just, all you have to do is reproduce the things. You don't have to pay people to develop them and to figure out how to get satellite data back. It's right there. And in this modern age, my gosh, you can walk around with a cell phone that tells you what the restaurant is that you should be going to tonight. Why can't we be listening to the whales off New York?
Yeah, Boston has one LNG terminal already, so there's plans to build 2 more, and that's what...
No, there are actually 2 companies have 2 terminals each. There are 4 terminals built off Boston.
But it's one operation.
Two operations.
It's
Suez Energy and Accelerate Energy. Right. Yes, ma'am.
Speaking of, you mentioned early history earlier in this talk. Historically, how close did whales come to New York Harbor?
They were in the harbor.
They were
up under the George Washington Bridge.
And how far up the Hudson would they go, or would they stop?
They'd probably stop. The water gets a little funny.
Yeah. When was this?
But they were killing them right off of the beaches of Long Island.
And this was about 100 years ago?
Yeah, most of that would actually have been in the 19th century, but early parts of the 20th century.
Significant other populations now that you found. How many individual species did you find off of Long Island?
Say that again?
How large is the population that you discovered off of Long Island? Like how many individual species?
Don't know. We need more. We need to be doing this a little bit longer.
There's only one blue whale that was tracked?
Actually, there are obviously multiple blue whales that were tracked. But the blue whales they roam over that entire ocean basin. So when I track blue whales with the Navy system, there you see them coming out of the Denmark Straits, and then they'll come over toward Nova Scotia, and they'll come down off of the New England seamounts. This is their backyard, right? Now, fin whales, so we don't know of any areas of residency for blue whales, but we do know that the fin whales seem to take up these local spots of residency.
And they tended to stay about 70 miles off the shore?
The blue whales?
Yeah, or all the species.
No, blue whales, no, all the species, they're right in shallow water. I mean, if I'm tracking fin whales with that little cluster of 3 right off there, they're moving around all over the place in there. I mean, the day trips that go out off of, Sandy Hook, I mean, they're seeing, you know, fin whales 10, 20 miles offshore.
I found it, when you show us the track of that blue whale that you were following,
right.
I found it interesting. It stayed like right on the
So, right.
Like all the coastline.
Right. They tend to do that. And one of the reasons I think they tend to do that is there's not a whole lot for a blue whale to do in shallow water because of where it's where its other, where its network is and where its food is. So most of their food, they're diving into say 300 or 400 meters of water along a shelf break. That's where the restaurants are for them, and most of the other blue whales are out in that distribution. They also tend not to hang out too much with fin whales. For whatever reason, they usually, if fin whales come into an area, lots of fin whales, the blue whales will tend to leave and go somewhere else.
Pearson discovered any evidence that the shipping was disrupting them? Like, would they be going one direction, then a big noisy boat would be driving through, they turned away in the opposite direction?
I know that from other data sets, but not, we don't have enough for New York. So you will see, for example, in an area where you'll have a lot of animals, like say fin whales, you'll have a network of a population of maybe 100 or 200 fin whales in an area, and they're all chattering back and forth and moving around and feeding, and they're breeding as well. And then if a big ship comes through or someone goes in and starts prospecting for oil and gas exploration, or you have a fishing fleet come in and the noise level goes up, you'll see them vacate the area. And then when the noise goes away, they'll come back in. But this, we only did this for 9 months, and the way I look at it, we went out and did some prospecting, we made some discoveries, and just as we were sort of getting into the part of the discovery, the lights went off. Yeah?
Yeah, you mentioned that I don't know if you call it dialects in whales.
Yep.
From Mexico, whatever.
Yep.
Do they understand each other? I mean, is it like a whale from Mexico wouldn't want to converse with one from Portugal?
Well, they'd have a hard time finding each other, but because they can't hear each other on two oceans. But, well, these are some really interesting questions. So although, now remember, I'm only with the fin whale stuff. So for example, if I played you the fin whale song from Bermuda, and that would be very much like this. It'd just be sort of like this little elf in the back room tapping. And then if we went up a little north and we went to the Hebrides or something like that, and you listen there, they would be doing. And then if we went a little further north, then they'd have a little higher note, so they'd be. I can't even do it that fast, right? But these are males, right? And these are male songs. And this is basically, to put it crudely, this is hey baby, right? And what the females are doing, we don't know, but you do. Males roam, so we have now evidence of males that are singing the Scottish song, but we find the Scottish song off of Gibraltar, right? So they'll roam all the way down to the Iberian Peninsula and off of North Africa, and they'll even go into the Mediterranean. But basically, I think they're just searching for a date, right? They're moving all over the place. But then again, you have to realize it seems like a long way, but it's not a long way for a fin whale, right? And this whole breeding activity, this whole singing activity goes on for 3 or 4 or 5 months. So it's a very, very protracted. So the males are moving around. And we're still just discovering, because one of the other questions is, oh, well, if they sing for many, many months, in fact, we now have evidence they're pretty much singing year-round in some cases. Is the song the same every month, or is it changing a little bit over time? Right. So these are all questions that we're just now beginning to be able to delve into, and part of that becomes available to the questions become available to answer because we now have a decade worth of recordings. Another question you haven't asked is how long do they live? Right? How old is a blue whale? Well, ask yourself this question. How would you figure out how old a whale is? Right? If I had pictures of all of you from your family albums when you were little babies, and then I had you as a 3 or 4 year old, and maybe I had fingerprints or I had a little, now you'd have a genetic sample, I could then follow you through time and get some idea of, oh, wow, remember this? We have a picture of her when she was 5, and then she graduated from high school, and then got married and whatnot. Our ability to age these animals has been pretty, very, very difficult. And now with new techniques and some new evidence, we're finding out, my goodness, animals that we thought lived to be 50 or 60 years old are actually living to be 150 and 200 years old. So for example, bowhead whales, which are a right whale that went up into the Arctic and never came back, it was called the Greenland right whale. Well, Eskimo hunters off of Barrow, Alaska have found steel-tipped harpoons from the British whalers that were hunting off of Greenland in the 19th century. So an animal that's killed in 1993, or they found old, you know, spearheads from early Eskimo whalers that are over 100 years old. And now they've been able to look at the growth patterns and the, you know, look at aspartic acid in the eyes, and they're finding, oh my gosh, these animals live to be 100, 150 years old. So and what this makes me realize is how the challenge of understanding how these animals live over these large spaces, over long time periods. When I follow blue whales around using the U.S. Navy's SOSA system, tracking them out of the Norwegian Sea through the Denmark Straits, down to the New England Seamounts off New York, and then down to Bermuda, they swim as though they have an acoustic map. They have a complete map of the ocean. You see them go on straight lines for 300 miles, and they're just slaloming from one underwater feature to another. They're using their voices. They're using their acoustic memories, right? They can't see anything. They can barely see their tails, but they can hear each other 1,000 miles away. And when you look at this pattern, I mean, I could show you some of the data from where you look at these mosaics of animals, and their network, their social network is huge. Their social network is 100,000 square miles, right? It's the size of all New England and New York and Pennsylvania put together. That's their social system. They're not living in Central Park, right? Or just take Central Park and, you know, blow it up a few orders, not blow it up, sorry. Take Central Park and expand it, right? So that's the way you have to think about this, is the scale over which these animals are living.
What was the original rationalization for the New York funding? What was the original goal of the project, or how'd you get it?
Again, it was to start Nicole Minovitz, who came and started working for the Department of Environmental Conservation. She was the woman standing on the boat next to the little yellow pumpkins. Wanted to basically engage the Department of Environmental Conservation in conducting more basic research into the marine ecosystem off New York. And again, knowing that there are responsibilities in terms of endangered species and monitoring for endangered species, it was like, okay, let's go find out what's there. And she knew about the work we've been doing off Boston. So that was sort of the impetus. And then, of course, as typically happens, you know, once you take the telescope and you start looking into the night sky and you realize, oh, there are craters on the moon, it's not made of cheese, and then you start going, oh, well, what's that beyond that? Oh, they're planets, and then they're stars. And so there's a cornucopia of sound that we're discovering off New York, most of which we don't know what it is we're listening to. So when someone says, oh, well, what's your latest expedition? Are you going to go down to Elephant Island on the, you know, Antarctic Peninsula? Or what are you doing in the Arctic? It's like, my goodness, we have expeditions right off 10 miles away, 20 miles away. There are things to be discovered off New York right now that I believe have value. They have social value, and they have health value, and they enrich our lives.
I think one other point to make, too, is that there's this initial sort of honeymoon phase, period of excitement. Hey, we recorded for a year. Look at all this stuff we found. The story's done. And there isn't this sort of excitement for continued monitoring over a longer period of time. That's sort of dull. But what we found from our work in the Gulf of Mexico in response to Deepwater Horizon is that what really constrains our ability to interpret the data is the complete lack of long-term baseline data. That is, this kind of recording is expensive. There's parts of it that will catch public attention and it gets exciting, but a lot of it is sort of really just slogging away doing the data analysis. But for these animals that are living so long, a 9-month snapshot of data is just a little glimmer in their life. It's not this extended time period, but these are the sort of temporal scales over which we need to be understanding their life history and ecology.
Yeah.
You guys are getting most of your funding for this type of research from the industries, right? Energy industry, so LNG in Boston, and I'm assuming BP.
It's a mix. It's a mix of there is some federal funding coming from NOAA. There is some and some funding coming from oil and gas companies in different parts that are particularly sensitive to exploration or recovery.
Yeah, and sometimes those monies are channeled through a federal or a state agency. They're sort of buffered that way, and sometimes they're coming. So some of the work we've done up in the high Arctic is through a contract with an oil and gas company that is part of their requirement prior to going do anything. So Canada will say, before you do anything, you better go prospect and find out what animals are there. And you need we need 3 years of baseline data to find out what we should do to mitigate any activity you might have.
So if they get serious about, I say, like opening up the offshore continental shelf, the oil and gas exploration, like the companies in Pennsylvania or whatever.
Yeah.
Like thinking about doing LNG exports from New Jersey. Would that be the potential to go to them at 3 years ahead of development starts and then start?
Absolutely.
If they recognize that it needs to be done 3 years ahead of time. What some of the way these cycles typically go is that they'll say, okay, we're going to start construction a year out. Let's get 6 months of baseline data. And that's helpful for that 6 month window. But we get year to year variations, we get seasonal variations. And just having that short reporting time isn't necessarily enough to be able to understand longer term patterns.
You like at least a 3 year sort of
ideally, yeah. Okay. But you know, at some level we take what we can get.
Definitely multi year.
Yeah, a little bit of data is better than no data, but it's certainly not ideal.
But so up in Boston, is the funding sort of in perpetuity, or is that going to come to an end from industry as well?
The funding for the LNG projects, they are mandated to continue the real time buoy system for the life of the project, their project.
Whose mandate?
The permits state in their
the federal permits?
Federal and state permits mandate them for the cradle to grave, if you will, of the project. So it may be a 25, 30 year project. And part of the discussions that are ongoing now between industry and federal and state agencies, states are sort of coming along a little bit less so than the federal agency. So Department of Commerce and the Interior, so Bureau of Ocean Energy and NOAA, and now industry, you are getting people in the same room recognizing it's in everybody's best interest to build the monitoring and mitigation requirements for the natural world into the plan from the very beginning. So you could go now, and I'm not stating anything that's not known. So you could go to, say, the U.S. Navy. So you've probably all heard that the U.S. Navy has had a bullseye on its head, and they went to the Supreme Court because they got in trouble over their mid-frequency sonar and whales dying, right? And they got into trouble with low-frequency active sonar. They spent in 5 years, the first 5 years of this, they spent $122 million in litigation, right? Go ask Shell what they spent. But they've lost in the Arctic because of not taking a proactive approach to the environmental issues, right? The smartest thing to do is be proactive and build the environmental knowledge building, to engage the environmental knowledge building into your business plan from the very start. Because everything that we're talking about is cheap, right? You're talking about $1 million a year to understand the ecosystem off of New York? Are you kidding me? I mean, that's ridiculous. You could get a penny from everybody. Well, you get more than that, right? You could collect beer cans and you can make $1 million. And if we don't get it right, you don't get a second chance. So I'll get off my soap opera, but it's like, it's really trivial. And so when I'm in a room with people and they're complaining about how much it's going to cost them to do environmental monitoring and mitigation for endangered whales, it's like, I don't have any sympathy for that particular argument. Because business-wise, it's cheap, right? Now, Now we're getting in, when you get into alternative energies like wind and whatnot, where there is no margin, that's different. But we ought to be building up a knowledge base of what's happening in the ocean off our coastal habitats before we just go and destroy it.
It sounds almost like you're saying that in New York, since the state is so hard up or doesn't want to put the resources there, that this could be like that, you know, the bright side, like if that LNG terminal goes through off of Jersey or something. I want to make sure I'm kind of getting it right. It's like if the state wouldn't pay for anything like this, even the semi-permanent net that you guys want to put,
yeah,
is the only other funding source that you would look to then industry and the feds? Is that right?
You know what I'd like to look to? The public sector, right? That people, right? What if everybody gave $20, right? Or, you know, that whatever it is, why don't we as a society invest in it, right? I mean, that's another option, right? Yeah, New York State financially is not in great shape, right? And they, finding $1 million and justifying $1 million to listen to whales off New York probably isn't going to get a whole lot of traction up in Albany, right?
How is Jacksonville being funded?
That's being funded out of NOAA. So Department of Commerce, and basically, you know, how do I say it nicely? I mean, basically you go and have bake sales, right? You have car washes and bake sales to raise $300,000 for a program a year, right? So you're investing less than $1,000 a day to monitor, do this monitoring, right?
And the scope of the Jacksonville and Savannah projects are almost sort of on the scale of like pilot projects. We've had, you know, one or two units in for a couple years here and there, but it's not the 19 element archival array that it is off of Boston.
Yeah, it's not a system. It's basically just a
proof of concept.
Proof of concept.
I don't want to interrupt the conversation. I just want, for those people who aren't a real sub schedule and have to be around 30, I want you to feel that you're able to do that without interrupting anything. For everybody else, please feel free to stay.
Yeah. I love the questions. We love the questions.
I just had one. Say it takes you another couple of years to get this funding. You finally get it. Do you have any guess on what you expect to find? I mean, can some of these rare species you say you were shocked to find, could they just be in bigger numbers all of a sudden? Does that happen to whales just start to populate in the area?
There's expansion possibilities, but now you also have to realize that these are very large, long-lived animals. I mean, a right whale will breed optimally every 3 years. So it takes decades to see that population come back. I think what we're going to find is, well, we'll probably expand our knowledge about the space and the time of which these animals are in the area. And then we're going to have more discoveries. I think where the discoveries are going to be is in the fishes. And other things that we never expected to be there. I mean, there's some now discoveries about benthic organisms. Now, this is sort of nerdy science, but the, you know, shrimp make sounds, fish make sounds. There are no known deaf marine vertebrates, right? So everybody's paying attention to the sound. So I think it's going to be basic discovery and expanding the time and space over which these animals are utilizing New York.
But in the context of the right whale, you know, the right whale whaling industry pretty much collapsed at the end of the 19th century, and they were thought to be extinct and completely gone. And there's sort of this rediscovery of, holy cow, we have right whales. You know, in 1950, you know, early 1950s was when right whales were realized to be still surviving. And so in that time, since the 50s, they've attracted quite a bit of attention. So you know, over this 50-year, 60-year time cycle, and this is sort of an example of, we now have effective legislation, protection, and mitigation for right whales, and it has sort of begun to allow their recovery. But again, it takes a long time, takes a lot of investment, and it takes sort of a mandate from either the public or the federal government.
You said you didn't know what was bringing back the whales. Maybe by studying other species, maybe you'll find the answer.
Yeah, and on that notion, I mean, think of what some of the rivers, you know, along the coastline that are feeding, New York and Connecticut and the rivers that were the great breeding grounds for spawning, for salmon and other fish. You dam them up, you pollute them, and pretty much you'll collapse that whole population. And then as you start protecting them and letting them come back, well, decades later, now we're starting to see the recoveries. And, you know, it may seem simplistic, but healthy populations of marine mammals and fishes mean that the ocean is healthy, and that's our health, is the way I look at it. But it's a long-term investment. This isn't going to be one of those things where overnight you get your solution. This is something that we as a society have to realize, oh, this is valuable to us, so that my children and my grandchildren and your offspring and, you know, everybody, that there's a long-term benefit.
Any species you're looking at are targeted by the Icelandic or Norwegian whaling industries?
Oh,
different?
Minke and Finn, but...
Is it a big impact on those populations? Not too bad.
No. No, those minke whales will breed every year, and fin whales are breeding every 2 years at least, and their populations have shown a real strong recovery. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Did you say that New York State, they pulled out of the funding? Was there an amount of time that they promised, or was it just they gave you partial funding? Or?
Well, we had a period of time over which we were going to have funding, and that's what everybody assumed, because that was what contractually happened, and then we only received about half of the funding. Yes.
I know that, because of what you just explained, that it's really only like a snapshot of data from New York waters. Is there anything new from analysis of those recordings that you guys know that you haven't made public since you were last talking about hearing the mating sound of the blue whale? Is there anything that you could sort of tell us, any more specifics, at least off that snapshot?
Well, we pretty much stopped, and once we finished our report for the DEC, we pretty much stopped delving into those data.
Let me rephrase that. I know that when I wrote about it, I was like, blue whale off Long Island. So
yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping maybe I can tell my readers something new, at least off this tiny sliver that we have. Can you give us a little more detail or new, you know, numbers? You'd mentioned that, you know, all, like, what, 7 out of 12 of the big whales are passing by. Can you just sort of tell us a little more what that snapshot helped us learn about whales
that?
Here?
Certainly one component is that by being able to compare, some of the work we're doing now is comparing our concurrent recordings from New York and Massachusetts Bay. What we can find is that we have fin whales, you know, and you saw this from the so that throughout the year, fin whales are singing at the same time in Massachusetts Bay and New York. So the null hypothesis would be is that we have one single group of fin whales, similar to right whales. They start off in one area and they migrate up the coast, and once they're gone out of region, they're gone. But the fact that you have this concurrent singing by fin whales in these two areas at the same time definitely supports this idea of these two distinct populations that are there all the time. Similarly, in Massachusetts Bay, we see fin whales there year-round. And for our long-term sort of acoustic monitoring that we do with the oil and gas companies, fin whales are easy to find. I mean, they show right up. We look, we focus in right on that frequency band, and hey, yep, we got fin whales, and they're almost every day.
So there are minke whales. Well, we didn't really pay much attention in our analysis to minke whales, but we know there are minke whales there. So this is, you know, in a Cornell University sense, well, there's a great project for a student to take this on. But we haven't published on detecting 7 species off New York. There's a lot to be done.
And the other thing, too, is that being able to sort of now have an understanding of the fact that there are these 7 species raises the question of, well, these species aren't vocalizing in isolation of one another. I mean, you know, so what the time that has passed since the project ended has allowed us to take some perspective and sort of come up with new questions. And so it's the idea of envisioning ocean basins as sort of an acoustic community. It's a collection of singing species which we don't know how they interact. We don't know if they're saying anything to each other, but they're not singing all by themselves. They can hear the other animals. And so this is sort of the forefront of where it's going, and sort of being able to look at, you know, one of the terms we use in bioacoustics is this idea of acoustic ecology. These are animals that make their living using sounds. It is a fundamental aspect of their life history. And when we look at sort of how sounds propagate over coastal systems, we look at how anthropogenic noise sort of will mask some of those sounds and how they're communicating with each other, it sort of almost changes the paradigm of how do we understand how these large vertebrates and small vertebrates are interacting acoustically in the ocean.
So this wouldn't help you, not only would it help you understand who's going by, get a rough idea of numbers, but also get more clues into the interactions between different species at different levels there?
Exactly.
Right.
The other thing that we have done is we have used, so if you think back to that map that Chris showed of all the little red spots along the Atlantic coast, what we can now begin to do is do meta-analyses both from a biological perspective but also an ambient noise perspective over how, you know, how does the coast of Savannah sound compared to New York Harbor? And we can look at something simple like some metric like shipping traffic and quantify the number of ships per hour with sound. But we can also sort of look at, you know, Savannah is very shallow water. The New York Glide is much deeper. Sound travels differently in different depths of the ocean. This is part of some of the games that the whales are playing. These low frequency sounds propagate very far distances in deep water, but they attenuate really rapidly in shallow water. And so you have these different sort of physically structured environments. What that means is this sort of acoustic backdrop of ambient noise, a collection of environmental, anthropogenic, and biological sounds will differ between habitats. So New York now is one of these sort of critical pieces along this sort of story we're trying to tell along the Atlantic coast.
So I just want to make sure I understand that correctly. So if you have enough data, if you have enough data in different places, is there a way that you can correlate the acoustic data in terms of, you know, the biological aspect of the acoustic data with acoustic data from that's being produced by humans? Mm-hmm. So could you plot if there is indeed an effect?
Yeah, and it's definitely one of these sort of ongoing projects that we're working on.
Okay, are there data out there can you talk about that a little bit more if there are data?
Can I show you a couple examples?
What's that?
Let me show you some examples.
Okay.
Because this is a really important point, Aaron, I'm great you brought it up, is that this whole thing about the acoustic habitat and the acoustic ecology, and what is the impact of all our various activities on that acoustic habitat, right? So here is a authentic example of this. So this is off of Boston. So here's our map here. Here's Cape Cod, right? And this Stellwagen Bank, this sanctuary is in here. This brown line represents the track of a ship. So ever since 9/11, there's been an automatic information system that's been being brought up by the U.S. Coast Guard. So every ship that's over 65 feet and 300 metric tons has a transponder on it. And those data are being collected by Coast Guard and made available to NOAA, Department of Commerce, right? And we collaborate with Department of Commerce, so we now have been working with them closely off Boston. Every ship that comes in, we have all those bottom recorders, so we have a library of sounds of every ship. So it's as though we had microphones out on JFK and LaGuardia. And every plane that comes in, we have the sound of that vehicle moving through space. So here's another, this is a little bit abstract, but this witch's hat or this candy kiss represents the loudness of my voice as you get further and further away. So when you're very, very close to me, my voice is loud, and that sound gets less intense as I get further away from you. And there are physical rules. This is all ocean physics, right? So the color here represents the loudness, okay? So it's very loud near me, and as I get further, you get further and further away from me, it drops down and gets very quiet until it gets to a point where you can't hear me anymore, okay? And that's black, right? So that's think of it as an acoustic space. We all do this. We walk along the street having a conversation, and if it was really quiet, if it was 2:00 in the morning, we could be walking up 7th Avenue and having a conversation across the street. And then a truck drives up the street, and I could keep talking, and you'd see my mouth move, and you wouldn't hear anything. Only in this case, the whales don't see their mouths move, right? So that space expands and contracts as the noise comes in and out of my life. So now I'm going to show you what happens to, I'm right here, I'm calling, this is my space, and the ship comes in, and you'll see my space contract as the ship comes in. And this is all scientifically authentic, right? This is not made up. Here comes the ship. Whoomp. Okay? So that, what I'm doing is I'm, you see what I'm doing? We're mapping how much space I have as the ship comes in, gets closer and closer and closer. Bingo. My world just shrinks. We all know what this is like. You know the difference between being in a bar that's loud and you can be a couple of feet away from someone having a conversation. You raise your voice, and after that, you can't hear anything. Does that make sense?
Chris, can you show them do you have the piece where the ship comes into Boston Harbor and actually the light?
Yeah, I'm going to show you the...
That's a really great vision.
So this is, I refer to this as the Van Gogh, okay? So here's Provincetown down here. Here's Cape Ann, and Boston's over here. And each of these lights now I'm looking down onto all those witches' hats, right? So this is the tip of the witch's hat, and because of the light in the room, you can't see my space. But that full space of that cone would be maybe this big. You understand what I'm saying?
But do those represent whales?
Each one is a whale. So each of these is the space of a calling whale. And there are more whales down here because when they were doing all the aerial surveys, this was a higher density of animals. There was food down here, and the other animals were distributed. Okay, so this is the network. This is our network. All right, and now I'm going to show you what happens, and there's going to be a clock up here. This is the 3rd of April, and you're going to see a clock, and you're going to see the ships come in and out. And the footprint of the ship is the acoustic footprint. That's the space that ship engulfs with the noise. There's some small boats coming out of Boston. Here comes a big commercial ship into Boston. So the radiated noise from that ship basically engulfs this amount of space. And if you can't see the light of the whale underneath the radiance of the noise from the ship, that means that animal can't hear and be heard by any other animals. So this is now where we're going with this whole notion of acoustic habitat. And
great, but so what? I'm not trying to be flipped, but so what?
Right, so what? So what we're now able to show is that these animals are losing roughly 85% of their opportunities to communicate.
For a very short period of time.
No. On average over a month, they've lost 85% of their opportunities to communicate because there's the shipping traffic, even in Boston, even as low as it is in Boston, means that they can't maintain their social network. So what you're...
They're in the shipping.
They're living in an urbanized habitat, right, from all the stuff. And now we're adding the fishing boats and we're adding the ecotourist boats. And what it's showing is that these animals use sound to form their aggregations, to find food, to find mating groups. And what you're constantly doing is you're tearing that social fabric over and over and over again.
Because aren't the ships coming in at a continuous rate? I mean, the intervals, I mean, how often does a big ship come in there? Whatever.
Well, in Boston, it's about 5 large ships a day. It's modest. But there are a lot of small vessels coming right through a critical habitat. But the noise from the ships has never been considered part of the impact on the critical habitat. So this is where a lot of this is going, and what Aaron was talking about. We can now do this comparison between Jacksonville, Savannah, Charleston, you know, New York, Boston, etc. So now there's a major push coming out of Department of Commerce, out of NOAA, to look at, it's called, you know, coastal zone management, ecosystem-based management, to understand how the noise from all of our activities is changing the acoustic habitat over the entire coastline.
And is there any way of knowing now if this is affecting their longevity or, you know, affecting mortality?
Yeah, that's the $64 billion question. That right now, what we can do is we can we can generate the data that says how much of your acoustic habitat have you lost and how often are you losing it for different species. Because this is for a right whale. This picture looks different for a fin whale, or it looks different for a haddock, right? Because they are doing different things with their voices. And that's where we're having, you know, there are multiple meetings going on trying to first, and it's called looking at cumulative impact. And it's even just trying to get your mind around the concept of a cumulative impact. How do you quantify the cumulative impact from whatever the activity is? In this case, it's ocean shipping. Not to mention coastal shipping, not to mention, oh, we're going to be building and putting 1,000 wind turbines off in New Jersey or Delaware, whatever it is, right? So, does that make sense? Yes, sir?
Sort of an odd way to look at it, maybe, but do they start swimming in circles? Do they just start going in the wrong direction? Do they?
Oh, no, you know what they, you know what right whales do?
No.
They stop calling. So what? Basically, we're all chattering. We're keeping our network open because we're calling each other. The noise level goes up, and everybody basically stops calling. And now, this is the same reaction they have to a gale, a big storm that comes through New England. And for 3 days, the noise level goes up. And basically, it's as though they basically say, I'll call you on Monday, right? Everybody just shuts down. And as the storm passes and the noise level drops, we all start chattering again. Only in the case of a storm, it's usually multiple days, whereas this is happening multiple times during the day. So what you see is this constant stopping and starting of their communication. And that little animation I showed in Cape Cod Bay, what you see is their countercalling. Their network breaks down, and it could impact their aggregations. So you start seeing this constant sort of tearing of their social system.
So it's stress.
Yes. And in fact, that's where there are now projects being proposed where could we actually monitor for stress hormones in these animals? Is there some way we could actually get a metric on it? And in many cases, we know that there is no overt reaction, that I can't see anything happening with you, even though you're being stressed out. But your heart rate's gone up, your corticosteroids are going up, but something's going on, but you seem to be behaving normally, right? And so those are some of the bigger questions, because this issue off Boston is trivial compared to what's going on in other places.
And just to follow up on that too, the sort of in a comparative context of biology, if you go into the lab and you sort of have elevated noise levels to songbirds or rats and mice or primates, they definitely show a physiological shift in hormonal stress levels. In response to loud noise. So one could, you know, hypothesize that whales are no different than all other vertebrates. It just the data haven't been collected yet.
Is this the sort of thing that if you were going to try to equate it to humans, that you can't, since they're such long-lived animals and we can't exactly, you know, look at them up close very well, that this could be having some sort of effect, you know, like, I don't know, high cholesterol or something on humans, that it's some sort of hidden effect of environment or behavior that could have long-term effects that you're not going to see right away?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so these are chronic, right? In fact, one notion is that why are North Atlantic right whales doing so poorly compared to other populations of right whales around the world? The ones off Africa, Argentina, Chile, Australia are all recovering. They're growing at, you know, 6-8% a year. This group is maybe growing at 1-2% a year. And one notion is that, well, they were clobbered down to almost nothing. As Aaron said, they thought they were essentially extinct. But in this particular part of the world, the industrialization of the North Atlantic has occurred. As the commercial hunt ended, the industrialization of the North Atlantic and the noise levels have been going up steadily throughout the century, and it's a chronic impact. Where there's so few of us that we can barely find each other, and then it's even made worse by the fact that we can't hear each other. But that, again, that's just a hypothesis. But I think you're dead on. It's the chronic issue we're talking about. Yes, unfortunately, in this species, they get hit by ships. And when you hit a female with it's pregnant, you've just done a serious, had a serious impact on the reproductive capability of that group. So a lot of the mitigation has gone towards trying to slow ships down or modify some kind of behavior like that to reduce the ship strikes.
But not the noise.
But not the noise, no.
I know you said this before, but just again, can you sort of quantify the shipping traffic in Boston versus, say, the shipping traffic coming through New York Harbor to give us a sense of what the volume is here compared with there where it's being tracked?
I know, Ira, you know the shipping?
1/8, something like that.
1/8, not 15%. Almost an order of magnitude.
Like 8 times the traffic here that there you would have in going in and out of Boston Harbor.
Yeah, 8 times here. I mean, that's ballpark, something like that.
Yeah.
Is that something like Commerce Department would have that, or?
Well, you can look at just the report
from Port Authority.
But that's they're more fishing boats and.
That doesn't include a lot of the small vessels.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, can be horrendous. Like an ocean tug. Can be horrendously noisy. Yes, sir.
Certain naval vessels have props that for stealth capabilities. In other words, they can go the same speed, the same everything, but they're not loud.
Yeah.
Is that something that could be used in commercial?
It can be applied? And it's being considered. The International Maritime Organization is now has over the last 4 years has slowly been adopting some policies, but. There are, how do I say this? You know what it's like. You can be in your cabin in Maine, right? And it's a beautiful, early September day, and you're writing, and everything's just fine. And then some bozo drives down the back road in a truck with no muffler. And all it takes is that one guy with no muffler to, basically permeate the habitat. And a lot of these ships are, it's an investment, and you can't retrofit them, right? So, and what you're listening to with the noise is basically cavitation of that propeller, right? And the cavitation etches the blades, and so they deteriorate or get a little bit of shaft vibration. So there are ships that have been built that are 3 orders of magnitude quieter. So they can be considerably quieter. And the best examples of these are in the cruise ship industry, right? You don't want to have a stateroom where your whole mind is just being rattled all the time. You're not going to do it. But the cruise ships are remarkably quiet.
Are you talking about azipods versus diesel engines?
Right, that's one solution, yeah. And sometimes it is just blades.
So if it's possible, could you give your contact information to everybody who's here?
Right? Sure.
Unfortunately, our wonderful speakers have another engagement they have to get to, so I am going to have to be terribly rude
Okay.
and wind things up. But if you could please give your contact information.
Oh, sorry.